Hello and welcome to Wine Blast. What a joy it is to have you here with us. And this is a particularly fun programme that we know you're going to love because we are getting down with the cool kids doing funky things on the English and Welsh wine scene. We'll be finding out what they're up to, why they're doing it, and how it all tastes.
Yeah, important to clarify from the outset that we are not cool. I know that won't come as a surprise to lots of you, but you know, our children remind us of this fact regularly.
Every day.
So we are making no claims on that front, to be clear. We are perhaps hoping that, you know, by associating ourselves with these people, some of that may rub off on us, but you know, it's a sort of vain hope.
It's pretty desperate, to be honest. But hey, we're more than happy to give the limelight up to the brave people taking risks, heading gamely off-piste to explore dangerous and potentially divisive territory in the quest to make exciting, edgy wines that defy expectations and inject a bit of fun into the UK wine scene. You know, they're pushing back boundaries and revealing new potential as they do so. That's something we are all too happy to support and champion.
Yeah, apart from anything else, it's fascinating. Here's a taster of what's coming up.
They're going to be divisive. Our wine's already divisive. I think they're only going to get more divisive. You've got to be brave enough to produce what you're really passionate about.
You know, we're making naked wines effectively. There's nowhere to hide.
I think people are really up for something different. It seems like they're quite intrigued by what we're making. And when they actually taste it, people are quite genuinely happy.
Everyone should be experimenting. We should be known as the experimenting nation of the world.
Tommy Grimshaw from Langham, Sergio Varillo from Black Book, Susan Kinsey-Jones from Wynyard Rocks, and Jose Quintana from Vagabond there. Now, we'll be hearing more from all these guys in a bit, and we'll be tasting and recommending some pretty funky new wave English and Welsh wines along the way.
Including one of the best English sparkling wines we've tried in a long time, which is very exciting indeed.
It is so good.
Yeah.
It is so good. I cannot wait to get onto
no
that.
Spoilers.
No
spoilers.
Okay, I'll try my hardest. Yeah. So anyway, well, let's then shift focus to setting the context.
Yeah, good idea.
Now, I think most wine lovers and certainly loyal followers of this pod are very aware of how exciting English and Welsh wine is right now.
Yeah.
The quality of the traditional method sparkling wines is well recognised, up there with Champagne and other great fizz regions.
Yeah, yeah.
And the best still wines are also starting to gain a following, you know, particularly the top Chardonnays, Pinot Noirs, Rosés, that kind of thing.
All that kind of jazz.
That jazz.
Yeah, you know, I think that's all pretty well established now. Obviously, it's still early days, though. You know, this new dawn of world-class wine, you know, both sparkling and still, only really kicked off in the UK in the mid to late 90s.
Mm.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
With
mean,
the likes
really,
of sort of Knight Timber and Ridgeview leading the charge with the fizz, and then maybe Chapel Down and Gusbourne with the stills.
But now, you know, the wine scene is, you know, as it starts to mature a bit, what we're seeing is an increasing emergence of what we might, I suppose we might term guerrilla winemakers.
Nice.
You know, the punk rock producers.
Yes.
Who are not afraid to defy the establishment and explore the world of quirks and kinks outside the mainstream, you know, often to brilliant effect.
Yes, yeah. So that world of intrigue and subversion and creativity is what we're going to dive headlong into now. We'll be shifting from a London railway arch to tales of vines being savaged by sheep in the Welsh hills. Can you believe it? I can, actually.
So can I, funnily enough. We're talking
dangerous,
UK.
Dangerous, those sheep in Wales. Anyway, we're also going to touch on a wine inspired by electric folk music.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking, I don't think we've actually covered Welsh wine before now either. So it's great to correct that minor oversight.
That needs correcting.
It does indeed. But one other thing, you know, I would say that these producers tend to be smaller players, you know, the Davids, if you like, in a land of Goliaths. Well, I suppose the UK isn't perhaps that developed yet, but but certainly we're talking the little guys in a land of bigger players. So they deserve our support because what they're doing is brave and almost always a labour of love.
Totally. You know, they're rarely making big quantities, are they? They're sort of doing things they believe in, but which almost by definition aren't the most commercial of propositions. But, you know, for a healthy wine scene to develop, it's important to foster this kind of creativity and buzz. So yeah, they need support to survive and keep on disrupting and doing interesting things.
Hence this programme.
Indeed.
Yeah. Right, so where should we begin? I think we should start in the wilds of Dorset. And I know we've given it this big build-up about small, lesser-known producers, but we're actually going to kick off with perhaps the best established and certainly largest of the producers we're going to feature, which is Langhammer. Because I just think what head winemaker Tommy Grimshaw and his team are doing is so interesting.
Yeah, and it's sort of disruptive in its own beautiful way. Just like grower champagnes have been disrupting that region for the past few decades, as we heard in our episode on that very topic recently. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to get ahead of myself here. We want to hear from Tommy. So we visited Langham in the rolling Dorset countryside on a very balmy day to join the team for some dosage trials, which was fascinating in itself, isn't it?
It really was. It was, yeah. But we grabbed some time to sit and chat with Tommy too.
It was in a slightly breezy vineyard, wasn't it, outside with other people.
It was beautiful. I wish we could see the picture because it was the most beautiful blue sky, sunny day, but it was a bit windy. But, you know, Tommy is... He's without doubt one of the most exciting winemakers in the UK right now.
He's probably one of the coolest as well, isn't he? And one of the youngest.
And one of the youngest.
Damn his eyes.
Makes you feel young. makes you feel old, not young. Doesn't well.
Can work
might,
both
might
ways.
Make me feel young. Who knows?
How are you feeling?
But yeah, when you think about it, I mean, he freely admits he only started working in wine for the beer money, and his introduction to wine was Buckfast.
Yay.
So he's done pretty well. Anyway, Langhammer make unapologetically characterful sparkling wine. Their main wines being Corallian, which is a Chardonnay dominant cuvée, and then Culver, a Pinot dominant blend. And I started by asking him what makes Langhammer different on the English wine scene.
Well, that's a big question to start with. I think it probably comes down to where we aspire to end up, and I think taking huge inspiration from the top growers in Champagne such as Salos and Agropar as a starting point, and then I think in the winery is probably where we put in the most unique in terms of the traditional method sparkling producers in no filtration, no fining agents, all wild yeast based ferments, high proportion of used French oak on the base ferments as well, and approaching the wine more like, you know, producing Burgundy perhaps would than, you know, another sort of just sparkling wine producer trying to make neutral base wines.
And if I'm a person going in to buy a bottle of sparkling wine and I choose Langham, what am I going to get?
You're going to get something that's really approachable. It's quite developed at a young age. Low pressure, so you'll actually be able to taste the wine. You won't get this real big aggressive fizz. And I think you should approach it almost like a fine white wine. You know, drink it out of a white wine glass, eat food with it, and and just enjoy it. You know, you don't have to read too much into it. But if you do want to read into the wines, I think hopefully you'll find there's great layers, lots of complexity and really nice texture to the wines as well.
I know you like to experiment. What's the riskiest thing you think you've ever had a go at?
I think everything we do here has got a lot of risk involved. I don't know. I think it's actually just taking that step to be as hands-off as you can and just constantly questioning things. You know, we've got one of our reserve tanks got a beautiful natural floor growing on it. That was one, they're usually topped fully to the brim, 4,000 litres in each tank. They've all got their own character, and one of our reserve tanks is much lower in acidity. So a few years ago, our rosé blend, I wanted to reduce the acidity on it, so we just drew 300 litres out. So it's quite a big headspace, which isn't good for wine. You know, it can oxidise more. Even as an oxidative producer, it's something we have to be aware of. And so that was just before harvest. I thought, we'll get the harvest in, I'll see what my tank capacity is, and then we can move this 3,700 litres of wine inside and keep it nice and protected. We came to it in November and saw that this natural floor was starting to develop. And
so that's like a film of yeast over.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know, I think maybe it gets my better judgment. We kind of thought we'd leave it rather than panic and try to sterilize it and chuck a load of sulfur in it. We thought, well, this could be a good learning exercise. Floor is, you know, quite fickle. It needs a specific constant temperature. It needs the right humidity. Our reserve wines are in concrete tanks submerged underground, so temperature consistent. And it obviously found a nice home. And so we thought we'd just watch it and taste it every single week. And it developed into something really strong and protective. And the wine beneath it is really interesting. It's brought an amazing viscosity to the wine, which I'd never imagined. And it's been a really interesting learning curve. So that's, you know, that's 3,700 litres of wine. That's probably quite a big risk.
What are you going to do with it, though?
So it's now part of our reserve. So a lot of it goes into our Corallium because it brings this slight nuttiness, but it's the viscosity that we love and a real saline profile that it brings to our Corallium now.
Amazing. So just a final question. You know, how do you see the future for Langham? And equally, how do you see the future for the English wine industry in general?
I mean, the immediate future for Langham is quite exciting because we've expanded the vineyard from 30 acres up to 75 and next year 85 acres. We've got a new winery, which we'll start building next year, ready for June 2025. So immediately, that's hugely exciting. And that's the immediate future. I think 10, 15, 20 years, I'd love to be seeing these wines throwing punches with the top grower producers in Champagne. We're kind of just getting started here at Langham, I think. I think probably the same goes for the UK industry as a whole. I think we need to be cautiously optimistic about the industry, not get too ahead of ourselves, and not think we know everything and we're in a perfect place all the time. We need to constantly learn, constantly improve, get a better understanding of our sites. I think that's going to be really interesting in 50 years' time when these vineyards are well and fully established and they've seen a huge amount of vintages. There's good data on them, and we'll be able to, you know, really start to understand the sites, and, you know, lots of exciting new producers as well. I think that's going to be interesting to see what comes next.
If you can imagine in 50 years tasting the wine from here, that's your ultimate dream wine, that you could see yourself the very best wine making here, how would you describe that wine?
It's really hard to answer that question without again talking about the producers that I admire so much, but yeah, definitely it's going to be oxidative. It's going to be rich. It's going to have long cork aging as well as long lees aging. I'd certainly want the wines to be head turners and just something distinctive. I think they're going to be divisive. Our wine's already divisive. I think they're only going to get more divisive. But hopefully the people that love our wines will love them even more. And I'm up to win over a few of the critics as well.
Is being divisive a good thing then?
I think it's easy to make nice wine. I think, you know, make nice wine, everyone goes, oh yeah, that's nice. But I think, look at any industry, the producers that are seen or the brands that are seen as the top of that industry, there's a lot of people that don't like them as well. And I think you've got to be brave enough to produce what you're really passionate about. And only then will you be able to produce the best of that style. I think being divisive is good, but not for the sake of, you know.
So better to be naughty than nice.
Sometimes.
Tommy, thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure.
Better to be naughty than nice.
Always.
I can feel a t-shirt coming on. But you know what I admire in Tommy's approach, and you can taste it in the Langham wines, is this very clear-eyed ambition of where they're heading, what they aspire to, which is to make really complex, characterful, thought-provoking sparkling wines in the style of the great grower Champagnes, but with an English twist, you know, and they're not afraid to take risks to do that.
Absolutely, and I love that stuff with Flore, you know, the sherry yeast. And the best bit is the wines bear them out, don't they? You know, so we had Langham's Rosé Fizz as our wine of the year last year, didn't we? And, you know, these are seriously fine wines, as you say. They even pull off low dosage in real style.
They do.
When actually, it's a rare traditional method, cool climate fizz, that does that in reality, in our opinion. Their Corallian, the Chardonnay dominant cuvée, is a lovely sort of invigorating, but also yeasty, biscuity, savoury wine. And the Culver, which is the Pinot dominant one, is gorgeously rounded and rich. Probably my favourite, I think.
But then the rosé, as you said, is just sensational. You know, it's got beautiful balance and complexity. And then the Brut Nature Pinot Noir 2019, that's just heavenly too. Yeah. You know, to my mind, it's definitely playing in the big leagues. You could put this in a lineup of grower champagne and it would certainly hold its own.
Yeah, and just going back to dosage, we did ask Tommy specifically why their wine sits so well with low dosage. And he identified four factors. Harvesting ripe fruit for complexity to offset the acidity. Then the fact they don't filter means the fruit isn't stripped out in the winemaking process. Thirdly, their oxidative approach helps give clean ferments and again adds the roundness and complexity of the wines. And then finally, barrel aging with batonnage gives more body and texture from the lees. Mm. All of that makes for a rounded, harmonious wine.
It's good to hear they're expanding too, isn't it? That's a positive sign.
It's really good.
You know, apparently they got to a crossroads about 3 years ago when they either had to expand or put the prices up. And to their credit, they decided not to put prices up. In fact, their wines, to my mind, are some of the best value English sparkling wines out there right now.
Yeah, I agree.
Would you agree? Yeah.
Agree.
I mean, Tommy said, until we feel our classic cuvées are competing and beating the best grower champagnes, I'm not going to put prices up to that level.
Love that logic. Love that
logic.
It's
really fair, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's good, as you say, they're growing. They're tripling capacity, I think, in total. And they're also making some new things as well. Now, we've been lucky enough to try a sneak preview of the latest release, which we've got right here sitting in front of us. It's an oak-aged, still, not sparkling, still Chardonnay, called Search for Enlightenment. It's the 2022 vintage, the first one. It's officially released on the 29th of April. We've got this sneak preview.
We did.
And it's not half bad, is it?
It's really good. It's really good. You know, it's built around, you know, mouth-watering, really mouth-watering, tangy, ripe lemon acidity. But they've managed to round out beautifully with a lovely creamy texture and nutty, yeasty complexity. You know, I'd liken it to a cool vintage of Chassagne, although I know you think it's more akin to a Premier Cru Chablis. But in either case, you know, it's definitely got that added bit of, you know, sort of steely British stiff upper lip.
It's definitely got a tanginess to it underlying it all. I mean, do you think, just tasting it, do you think they could go even bolder with this style? Do you think they could give it a bit of that sort of snap, crackle and pop, you know, that sort of more
famous flinty, Rice Krispie pop,
flinty struck match complexity into the mix? Do you think they could
say that? I mean, I'd love that, you know, because we love that style. Yeah. And I think the structure here could easily carry that. But this is, it's a brilliant kind of first attempt. And I reckon, you know, what they'll do is they'll fine tune it to what best suits their fruit and their house style over time. But you do get the sense at Langham there's so much more to come, and it's really exciting.
Yeah. Good. So time to move on. Coming up, we're moving from the rural bounties of the Welsh Hills to the urban delights of wines made under a London railway arch, as you do. Plus, dropping in a few other gems along the way. By way of brief recap, the wine scene in the UK is being diversified and disrupted by a growing number of producers aiming to shake things up, making ambitious alternative styles, like Langham's take on grower champagne, and now Chablis, or Chassagne, depending on who you listen to. And this movement goes well beyond England's staple styles of traditional method sparkling wine and still Chardonnay.
Too right it does. How does a glass of lo-fi purple Welsh bubbles sound?
Yeah, I mean, Welsh. But the purple bubbles sound good too.
Let me tell you. So, husband and wife team, James and Susan Kinsey-Jones, run Wynyard Rocks, a tiny, low-intervention vineyard in mid-Wales, sort of midway between Worcester and Aberystwyth on the West Welsh coast. Now, this is a fourth-generation sheep farm. Mentioned the sheep before, we're back to the sheep, with holiday lets. But James and Susan wanted to do something different.
And they've been on plenty of holidays to wine regions, always a good pastime, which we'd endorse. And as lovers of food, travel and wine, they thought, why not set up a vineyard and holiday cottage in this beautiful part of Wales on the edge of the mighty Radnor Forest? So they planted 800 vines, including the red Rondo variety, which we'll come on to in due course. The only problem being, they still lived and worked in London. And as James pointed out, travelling 170 miles to tend the vines probably wasn't the most efficient form of viticulture.
But they proved it was a goer. As their website says, it's two people trying to make wine on a hillside in Wales, as you do. Now, I met them recently at a tasting of Welsh wine in London and was inspired by their story. So we wanted to get them onto the pod to find out a bit more about why exactly they are indeed trying to make wine, natural wine, on a hillside in Wales.
So I caught up with them and asked them, was there a moment when they thought this could actually work?
Yeah, I think when we first, for me, when we got our first tiny Rondo harvest, and out of that we were able to make some still red wine. That was the very first kind of like experimental go at what we could achieve. And when we got those bottles back and it tasted like wine and it was something we liked, that was a real turning point. But there is a bit of a story that ahead of that point that I'm sure James can fill you in on.
Yeah, so we're obviously on a sheep farm, and my cousin farms, you know, he has sheep on our farm now. And one stormy night in mid-June, so, you know, everything's out in leaf, he for some reason put quite a few sheep in the sort of field adjoining the vineyard, and they managed to bust in and eat everything in the year that we were going to have our first harvest. So it wasn't just a little nibble. They'd managed to turn like every trunk into a chewed up toothpick. So, and I was like, my dad called me and said, "It's been a disaster." I was like, "What? What's this? Is Mum okay?" But it turns out, yeah, the sheep had bust in.
Oh,
I thought it was one or two, but it turns out it was 160.
160 vines out of how many did you lose?
This is the amazing thing. Most of them came back to life, and they managed to grow. And the following year, we got this tiny crop of Rondo, which is why we love Rondo these days. It's because, you know, it's the year prior that sort of determines the growth for the following year, you know. So somehow Rondo was so robust and resilient, it was able to, you know, get over the shock of being eaten by sheep to produce a tiny crop the next year, which kind of like, in our mind, like Rondo, we'll thank it forever.
Yeah.
So being able to, you know, produce wine in the following year. So
Rondo can survive a savaging by sheep.
Yeah, so I'm not actually worried about frost this year, you know.
I was going to say.
Wine.
And have the wines turned out pretty much how you imagined they would?
I don't know what, essentially, again, I think slightly naively when we planted it, our preconceptions were that maybe it would be conventional, but we kind of ended up going down the sort of more natural wine route. Out of pretty much meeting our winemaker, Mark Smith from Black Mountain Vineyard, and becoming friends with him because we lived in the same town. And then he said, "I can make you wine, but, you know, it's going to be natural because I don't have any chemicals anymore." So he's very much of a sort of off-grid, lo-fi winemaker. So, and at that point, we hadn't sprayed anything. We hadn't had any sort of synthetic inputs, used herbicides, pesticides, insecticides in the vineyard in any case. So it was a natural fit for us. So we just sort of started playing around with some of the initial harvests, and that's kind of defined what the sort of wines that we're producing, and very much it's defined what comes off the field, really. Each year will be completely different and be a reflection of what has occurred that year, rather than, you know, trying to aim for a specific style or you know,
consistency.
Yeah.
How important is that lo-fi approach to what you do now, and in a way your philosophy and your wine style?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much integral to our philosophy now. It's something that's kind of evolved over time, and it's now seems to be very much like the fabric of our identity. And it kind of trickles out into other things that we do on the farm and our approaches to things, and just trying to see things differently.
Yeah. Do you think it helps you stand out? Do you think it is quite an innovative approach in the UK still?
I think so. I mean, I guess like we're Welsh, which probably makes us a little bit different. You know, the majority of the vineyards in Britain are in England. But then I guess if you're going down the sort of more natural route, then again, you're in a different category again. So I think it's opened doors, let's say, or allowed us sort of access to different, you know, retailers, etc. by going down this route.
And it must be quite hard work, no?
it is hard work, yes. essentially, well, where we are, there's not really, we're not in like a wine part of Britain. So there isn't like the contract labour. You know, lots of vineyards have contract labour who come in and do this, that, and what you know, the other, whether it's, you know, pruning, bud rubbing, et cetera, et cetera. So we kind of have to do everything. And equally, we made it, you know, doubly difficult because, you know, we don't use the you know, we don't use a herbicide under the vine. We'll weed manually. So we've made life difficult for ourselves, but I think I feel it's become sort of integral to who we are and what we're trying to do.
If you could choose one wine that you've made so far that really captures the essence of what you're trying to do, what would it be?
It's like asking favourite child.
We've all got one.
We've all got one. Let's be honest. I think our Col Rondo is just something that it was our first wine, and yeah, the purple bubbles, the brambles, hedgerow, tasting like a crumpled bush after a barn dance is just, I think that really sums us up. It's just, yeah, we'd never tried anything like it before. A lot of people haven't tried anything like it before. And yeah, it's us, it's off the hills, it's off Wales.
And you've got to love a pun-based wine name, you know. As the person who thought up the pun, I think it's, you know,
I forgot to mention that, sorry.
I don't know. We're not particularly serious people. So I think, you know, so having something that's kind of like, I don't know, fizzy purple party juice is kind of like, feels great. And then it's kind of like interesting and it's fun. It's not serious. You know, it is what it is. So yeah, I think that's important to us as well.
So I was going to ask you, you know, how do you find this resonating with customers, with people who buy and drink the wine?
A good question. I think I think people are really up for something different. It seems like they're quite intrigued by what we're making. And when they actually taste it, and when we're present with people and they're tasting, and people are pleasantly surprised and seem quite genuinely happy. And
I think from like, because I guess we haven't done a huge number of events, but people locally, first they're baffled that someone's making wine in this part of the world. Then they're like, what on earth's natural wine? And then they go, it's fizzy red wine. So you're taking them down this, leading them down this sort of weird and wonderful path of like more experimental things. But end of the day, that, you know, they typically enjoy it. So yeah, I think.
Yeah, it seems to be received quite well. And I think people like the fun. And something we're trying to do, I think that we've ended up trying to do, is trying to make wine a bit accessible. And not, you know, we're clearly not from like a lineage of viticulture where we are. There's no like deep rooted history. So it seemed like we'd miss the point by trying to pretend like we're part of like a long line of grand estates of, you know, centuries of grape growing. So I think if we try and position our wine as something that is just kind of for any, if you like drinking and you like wine, then pretty much give it a go. That's great.
It's a fabulous approach, and I totally congratulate you for it. Guys, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You gotta love that story, especially the sheep. And they're brilliant people, aren't they, too?
Yeah. You know, at one point, they described themselves as belligerent because they just wouldn't be told no when they were first embarking on the project. And this partly because their site is not only fairly wet, and this being Wales, anyone who's been on holiday to Wales there will know just that, you included. but also because it's pretty remote and relatively high altitude at 230 metres above sea level, when most people say that anything over 100 to 150 metres in the UK can struggle to ripen properly.
But that's presumably why they're using hybrid varieties like Rondo and Solaris, because they're more disease resistant and they can harvest a bit later.
Exactly. And they did admit their yields are painfully low. Their Rondo is the best yielder, and at best they get is about 4 tonnes per hectare, whereas apparently elsewhere in the UK can yield up to 12 to 15 tonnes per hectare, so up to sort of 4 times more. But, you know, I mean, they're hoping to grow a bit, and demand from retailers is currently outstripping supply, so that's good news. They're aiming to push the holiday cottage, which they describe as idyllic and tranquil, which I can quite imagine. It sounds wonderful. And they may even do something on the foodie front in the future too.
Col Rondo Red Fizz, haven't we?
Yeah. And it's exactly as described. Really fun, definitely different. It's a Col Fondo method, so re-fermented in the bottle but sold hazy with the yeast lees still in there. And it's frothy and it's juicy and it's bittersweet, it's a bit earthy perhaps. Maybe one for summer barbecue quaffing, don't know. You know, with some Welsh lamb, butterfly Welsh lamb on the barbecue, why not?
And purple Welsh bubbles, who knew?
Purple Welsh bubbles.
There we go. Right, moving on from the valleys to Vagabond, the wine bar chain famous for their whizzy enigmatic machines dispensing all kinds of wines in handy small portions, including their very own English wines, because Vagabond has a tiny urban winery at the back of its Battersea venue, which is next door to Battersea Power Station.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Urban wineries have definitely become a thing in London now, which is great for people to discover. That said, as this goes out, Vagabond has just been taken over by Majestic Wine, so things may change in the future. Nevertheless,
hopefully not too much.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully not too much. Now, we headed in, didn't we, to talk to Vagabond winemaker Jose Quintana, who buys his grapes from vineyards in Oxfordshire, Essex, Suffolk and Sussex, before he works his magic on them in southwest London.
Yeah, we featured Jose's skin contact Ortega called Selena in our episode on orange wine. And as he's a self-confessed tinkerer, we wanted to ask him specifically about his funkier wines. Now, I should say, we were talking in their Battersea bar / winery, so it wasn't without some background noise.
Lots of people enjoying their wines there.
Jose, by the way, has a Spanish heritage and worked as a sound engineer and in property before training at Plumpton. And he started by talking about the Bacchus grape variety.
So we do... I have a tricky relationship with the grape Bacchus. It makes wonderful wines that are very approachable from a commercial sense because they're so expressive that they're very, very kind to drinkers that perhaps are new to wine because the aromas are so present and so obvious that they feel comfortable smelling those. But for me, I find them too in your face. And I wanted to try and look at a way of building texture, restraint into Bacchus. So we have tried to do a wine that it blends in some skin contact Bacchus with some barrel fermented Bacchus. And that's inspired from some of the wines I tried in Sicily where they use Cateratto and they use a small amount of skin contact to add texture, to add depth, complexity and layers. And some of those more spicy notes that you can get from doing these things gives, for me, the Bacchus a bit of more of a journey that isn't just aromatics and then a thin palate. So I'm trying to look at ways that we can develop Bacchus in a different way of maybe sort of elevating it and giving it restraint. So we do that, and that's a lot of fun. That's called Dios Mio, because Dios Mio in Spanish means sort of, oh my God. And it was a bit of a journey on the first time we made it. And sometimes I'd come into the winery and you'd think you'd have to throw it down the sink. It was, oh my God, I've ruined it. And then a week or so later, it would completely come round and it was, oh my God, amazing. So we call that in Bacchus being the god of wine, Dios Mio. Anyway, then we do a nice experiment wine that we're doing is with Ortega Skin Contact. I used to work with at Westwell with Adrian. He does a lot of work with Ortega Skin Contact. So what I did here was when I joined, I was handed a baton of a barrel of Ortega Skin Contact from the previous winemaker. But rather than just release it as a here today, gone tomorrow sort of wine, we decided to start a Solera system. I'm a bit of a sherry nut and I love sherries. And so the idea of to create an aging system or use the idea of Solera to age Ortega wine, and the skin contact that gives it that extra ability to age and stay fresh.
What do you think the Solera will bring to it then, rather than make it a vintage wine?
So what it brings to it is depth. Every time I taste it, at the moment we've got two levels of the Solera. We've got a wine from 2022 and then a barrel of the blend of 2018 and 2021. And just tasting them, the richness of spice that gets this Christmassy spice. It starts off as a sort of tangerine-y, light spice, but as it ages, the spiciness, the sort of cinnamony, nutmeg, spice deepens and deepens, and you start to lose a touch of that fresh tangerine, and it goes very much into dried tangerine-y marmalade-y character. And then, but it has a sort of a slow process of this, and so then it sort of really suits the Solera system of being then able to go and blend from that deep, rich character to the when you have skin contact or Tega in its initial year, it's all very floral, honeysuckle, honeyed, that fresh tangerine fruit comes through, some ginger spice, that sort of thing. So it lifts it all up, and then it takes this sort of brooding spice of the aged Ortega, and to be able to sort of play around with that and release sort of bottles of that blend each year. For me, it's a bit like, say, where you get aging in champagne, where nothing can circumvent it. You can't get to that taste and experience and flavour by anything else other than time. It's the same for me with this aging the wines. Now, I have no idea where it's going to go, and the oldest barrel we've got might next year just be, you know, gone, and, you know, and it not really work anymore. But that's the experiment, and the symbol of Vagabond is the fox, the idea being that it's this creature from the country that's come into the urban environment and is having to adapt, and it's sort of on its own, loved by some, hated by others, but having to be creative, having to sort of duck and dive a bit and do some different things to try and survive. And that's the idea with the winemaking as well. You know, we don't have the weight behind us to sort of stick 200,000 bottles on the supermarket shelf. So we have to get a story across to people. We have to connect people with the wine. But on the limited releases, that captures people's imagination. And last year, we was quite an exciting wine, came about from nowhere, sort of serendipity. I got offered some grapes that I wasn't expecting. And it was from a vineyard we already worked with, and we got offered half a ton of a mixture of Pinot Gris and Sauvignon Blanc from Essex. And I don't like to say no to these things, because if you say no, then you don't get offered it again, that's that sort of thing. But I had nowhere to put it. We did what we had nothing, no other way than to just we crushed the grapes, Pinot Gris, Sauvignon Blanc, destemmed, crushed into a Dolab bin. So it was co-fermented on skins for 7 days. And then we pressed off, and once a barrel became free, we went into barrel. It was one barrel. And I love skin contact Pinot Gris, skin macerated Pinot Gris. I think in Alsace they do some really great wines. So interesting to see, and interesting to see what the Sauvignon Blanc was going to bring to it. Absolute experiment. I've never tried a Pinot Gris Sauvignon Blanc co-fermented skin contact wine in my life, and we'll see what happens. And it's now been released, a limited release of like 280 bottles under the label Night Tripper. That's already sold out.
It's really good.
Yeah, we only released really a couple of months ago. And yeah, again, a wine that's not for everybody. It's a slightly raised price point as well. But when you tell people the story of the wine, and it's something interesting, and I think it worked. I would never have guessed it, but Pinot Gris has this quite fat, glycerol-y character. And it was really ripe. You know, it came in at 13% natural alcohol, but the Sauvignon Blanc acidity on the palate, balancing that out, giving this sort of star-shaped, prickly acidity, just for me, it really works. And so now the Night Tripper is going to be the experimental wine every year. So it's going to be Pinot Gris based, but if I get a little bit of Riesling or something like that, it'll go in. It'll all go in. It'll be, you know, chucked in together. We'll see what happens. And some of them are going to work, and some of them aren't going to work. But if you don't try, you don't know.
You talk about your story. English wine is new for many people. You're then making funky, fun English wines, cutting edge, you know, challenging perceptions, challenging norms. Does that just add to the story, or does that make it harder to sell and for people to understand and appreciate it?
I'm making creative wines because I I like to create, first and foremost. So I'm making wines that I want to make, and I'm incredibly lucky to be able to do that. I'm incredibly lucky to be making them in a setup whereby we have an opportunity to hand sell and tell the story of those wines to the guests. So first and foremost, the reason for the success of the winery is the success of the brand and the success of the route to market. And we have a route to market whereby the people and my colleagues in the bars, who I go round and constantly telling them about the wines and engaging with them, enabling them to tell the stories, enables us to make these slightly different wines and unique wines, because they are not just... If I made these wines and I had to make a million bottles of them and stick them on a supermarket shelf and let them sell themselves, I would not make the wines I make. It would be commercial suicide. So where that fits in the grand scheme of UK wine, I'm not really sure. I'm exasperated sometimes at how the UK wine industry thinks that it already knows everything that it needs to know and is ready to start thinking about protecting that we somehow know what we're best at already, only having been doing it properly for 40, 50 years. I think it's crazy. And we should be everyone should be experimenting, should be encouraged. We should be known as the experimenting nation of the world. We have such a unique climate. We have such a unique variety of microclimates and soils in the country, from granite to limestone to chalk to clay to sandstone. Why aren't we? Why isn't everyone experimenting? I don't understand. Yes, it comes with commercial pressures, but I think experimentation can be marketed as much as tradition.
Everyone should be experimenting. Mm. I totally agree. Don't you? You know, and we're really fans of his funky wines, aren't we?
Yeah.
Night Tripper 2022, this mad Pinot Gris Sauvignon blend, yeah. that's totally wacky. You know, it's got this mad Lucozade colour to leathery cherry and dried flower aromatics, and then succulent textured palate. It's just really different. And most importantly, it is delicious.
It's more delicious than Lucozade, I tell you what. We're talking about old school Lucozade, aren't we? Just to be clear.
Yeah, that's particular. But it's
has got this mad colour, hasn't it? But it's really off the charts. But it's great. And then the Selena, the skin contact Ortega from the Solera, that's really impressive too. Isn't it? Now, we should explain at this point that for anyone who doesn't know, a Solera is a fractional aging system, common in sherry, also used in champagne and some UK sparkling producers now, whereby you keep a job lot of wine aside, take a bit of wine out of it every year and top up the reserves with a bit of new wine every year. So it gradually gets more and more complex over time.
Just to change the subject slightly, I did ask Jose about price, which is something we haven't discussed yet, isn't it?
Yeah, good point.
A lot of these wines aren't cheap. Mm. Yeah, we have to say that. Jose's are around £18 to £40, which is relatively typical in this context. Mm. But he made the point that these are artisanal products with no economies of scale or equipment, pretty much handmade with love and attention. So a slow process using quality raw ingredients that do not come cheap. But even then, his wines do sell out because people buy into the story of what he's doing. And I think that's what's important. That's great.
Yeah, and I think that applies across the board here to all these kind of producers and wines, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I remember his quote to us when he visited, Jose said, "I'm not after making perfect wines. I want to make honest wines that have something to say. Wines with a cheeky smile."
Hopefully Majestic will want to keep that connection, I think. I think they will. And Jose's a brilliant winemaker.
Yes, you know. He is.
But anyway, we need to move on. Just down the road, we are going to Sergio and Lindsay Varillo, who are making a unique, quirky range of wines out of a railway arch near Battersea Park under the Black Book label.
Yeah, that was a slightly busier venue, wasn't it?
It was indeed.
A
small.
Sort of cramped railway
very
arch.
Very small.
Overflowing with barrels and eggs and boxes and bottles. Rush hour
trains.
And
when you say eggs, you don't mean, you know, the ones that you're going to scramble.
No, I know, they weren't scrambly.
Eggs. big eggs.
Big eggs you put wine in to make the wine, absolutely. Yeah. And we had all these trains going overhead and loads of forklifts and lorries bustling and beeping
crazy,
around outside. It was a proper hive of activity. As you know, it sounds a bit like we're in a sort of steelworks.
It does. Anyway, perfect for recording.
We've been fans of Black Book ever since we were blown away by their first painter of light Chardonnay, sourced from a vineyard in Essex, barrel fermented in this very arch, you know, just delicious wine.
Yeah, and they've been ploughing their own unique, quirky path since then, including playing around with peewees, which are hybrid varieties like Sauvignac and Cabernet Noir. And they've been trying out all kinds of different winemaking vessels and techniques. Now, Sergio's originally from Connecticut in the US and had made wine all over the world before settling in London. I asked him about his winemaking philosophy.
To be as self-indulgent as possible. No, it's my general philosophy, you know, we specialize in Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. That's my love. That's where I traveled the world learning and making in different climates and high-end boutique wineries and vineyards. So that's particular range. We really tried to polish it and make it refined and make it better. Now, where peewees and other types of experimental wines come into play is in a rightly apt name called experimental range. And these are blends, these are wines that are non-Pinot and Chards, at least not as single varietals. And so by rolling these varying wines out that we sort of push the boundaries a bit on, allows us the freedom to then apply that to the core range if it works. So the philosophy that we stand here is really, first and foremost, it's all about the vineyards. And, you know, there's a philosophy that's widely said throughout the winemaking community, which is you can't make good wine or great wine from bad grapes, but you can make crappy wine from great grapes. So we really focus a lot of attention on the vineyard. But once it gets here, we really sort of try to coax texture and length and mid-palate out of the wines. And we do so by using indigenous yeasts. All the wines go through malolactic, naturally serve in indigenous bacteria as well. We use a lot of barrel work to do that, varying size barrels. I mean, we're surrounded by, I don't know.
We're sitting here, aren't we? Every tiny corner has got a barrel in it. We can see that, you know, you're keen to use barrels, definitely.
Yeah, and, you know, and we use eggs and we use stainless steel. And so it's really a matter of trying to work out what works and what doesn't. We use between 10 and 40%. That was my cellar hand screwing something up. Los!
Yeah.
It's all fine.
We really try Cook's character. And 10 to 40% new oak goes in, and mainly our Chardonnay and Pinot Noirs. But it's ultimately trying to get the best out of what we can and without being too interventionist.
So which wines over the years would you say have been the most successful for you?
I think given that out of the gate, our 2017 Chardonnay was probably really, well, I know it's very well received, and that sort of stuck with us. Our Painter Light Chardonnay has certainly been one of our top sellers. Our Pinot Noir is quickly coming forward with that as well. Our Rosé has been surprisingly one of our really great sellers as well. And interestingly enough, you talk about weird and wonderful varietals, and what started the entire experimental range was our Col Fondo Sauvignon Blanc GMF. And despite its cloudy appearance and austere and sort of tantalating acidity, it is one of my favorite wines and seemingly a lot of other people's. So.
GMF?
GMF. Yeah. Can you explain that?
Yeah.
So it's an experimental range. It revolves around music that my wife and I like and the London transport system. So all the tiles you see on the bottles, the like big C of controversy, all stems from an element of the Lennon transport system. In a previous life, I used to work in music. I worked for a record label in New York and Connecticut and as a runner for AEG and concerts and et cetera. And so both music And concerts still are a big part of my life and my wife's. And so with our first wine, GMF, we named it after a song by this really amazing electro folk guy called John Grant, this American artist. He's had a very turbulent middle life and has come out of it on top, making the most incredibly beautiful music. And GMF, or Greatest Motherfucker, is one of our absolutely dear favorite songs from him. So that's for that. But we also have like the Mix Up, which is our white blend, and that's a Beastie Boys album. And so, you know,
if you money wasn't an issue, develop the urban winery of your dreams in London, what would it look like?
Ooh, I mean, this again, very self-indulgent. It'd be a place I'd like to go to. You know, it'd be sort of very focused on music with like live bands playing and sort of like it, we'd have really great wine and we'd have amazing vibe where people come and hang out. We'd potentially sort of incorporate a kitchen, you know, partner with a chef that is already existing and sort of get this like food and wine element happening, but a very casual environment and sort of just make it a meeting place, a place where people can just come and hang out and enjoy themselves and not feel a need that they need to sort of bring their pocket guide of wine with them to understand how to drink. So it's, you know, I grew up in a very unpretentious wine household and that's kind of stylistically what I like to bring to the table and where I like to go drink. So,
Sergio, thank you so much.
No, thank you guys. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I do love the sound of that winery, come bar, come kitchen, come music venue. Yeah. You know, it sounds so cool.
Yeah, it sounds way too cool for us.
Too cool for us, yeah.
We'd be the nerds in the corner with our pocket wine guides and writing tasty notes, wouldn't we? But no, I agree. It would be great to see Black Book take things to the next level. You know, I feel they may need a bit of investment or maybe a partner to make that happen. So if anyone out there fancies investing in a cool business, then reach out.
Yeah. It would be great to see Black Book really, you know, push on. You know, we've been fans, as you say, for a while, and we still love their Painter of Light Chardonnay. We tried the Reserve, the 2019 Reserve Painter of Light recently, and it was toasty and nutty and zingy, so complex, savoury, with that kind of electric undercurrent of acidity, and sourced from Essex, of course.
Yeah. And we've got right here, we've got their new Essex Pinot Noir.
Indeed.
Don't we? The Crow's Lane Estate Trouble Every Day Pinot 2020. They always have cool names, these wines. It's full of kind of stemmy, sappy red fruit flavours, some floral notes, and then a lovely sort of tangy, bittersweet finish.
Yeah.
Sort of lighter side, isn't it? A bit rustic, a bit natural.
It's lovely, though.
But really appealing, isn't it? Right, okay. So this has been a really long episode. We need to wrap things up. But before we do, we wanted to just name check a few other producers and wines who are doing good work in this sort of alternative sphere in the UK, didn't we?
We did. And first up, I want to give a big, massive shout out to Domaine Hugo, south of Salisbury in Wiltshire. Now, they farm biodynamically and use wild ferments, amphora, no added sulfur, all that kind of stuff. They really impressed me at the WineGB Awards last year, and we've just tasted the latest release of their fizz, which is the Domaine Hugo Single Vineyard Brut Nature, and it blew us away.
Stunning.
Is the only word.
So much character and depth. I mean, we've got it here, haven't we? It's been going on. We've managed to eke it out over weeks.
It nearly went in, you know, within the first half hour.
It's so full of nutty, yeasty, bready, roasted apple flavours with a sort of funky, oxidative, nutty complexity. Sort of shades of Fino Sherry in there, which we absolutely love. You know, the texture is wonderfully mouth-coating and fine, but rich. It's sort of fizz in surround sound. It's very artisanal, offbeat, eclectic, but beautifully done. It's a different dimension to English fizz.
I mean, I feel like sort of like a beautiful piece of that, of like fresh sourdough with warm butter and caramelized apples. And you know, what's also surprising is so much depth for a no-dosage wine. Yeah. It's so well-balanced. Yeah. And it's even hedonistic. I mean, when would you say that about a no-dosage wine from England?
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, sensational. Another one to pick up on is the Wary experience in the New Forest, where winemaker Guillaume Laguet, sorry if I'm not pronouncing that quite correctly, Guillaume, but Guillaume's originally from Switzerland. He is doing weird and wonderful things across a range of styles, including Orange Bacchus and making peewees like Orion and a pretty punchy Cabaret Noir.
Yeah, I think he's also doing beer and cider as well. Some really interesting things there.
Well worth seeking out. Absolutely. I think the Wary Experience. Well, Have a look. Really cool.
I'd also mention Westwell. We had them on our Red Dawn pod episode back in November 22, of course, and recommended their Field Red Blend there. But they do really interesting things across Fizz and White too. We'd highlight their Still Pinot Meunier 2022, which is really yeasty and tangy, but also quite rich in texture. Also, we've got here the Ortega Skin Contact 2022, which is really elegant and age-worthy orange wine with very sort of fine mouth-coating tannin, very sort of cultured and food-friendly.
Yeah, and we mustn't forget also their late-release Blanc de Blanc Zero Dosage 2013, which is pretty special too. Mm-hmm. You know, 9 years on the lees and so complex and invigorating. But to finish off, I just wanted to head back to Wales and mention Anchor Hill, a biodynamic, minimal intervention producer just outside Monmouth in southeast Wales, which makes a range of funky stuff. Yeah. And we particularly liked their red Pet Nat Method Ancestral non-vintage, didn't we? Made with Triomphe and Chardonnay. It's really characterful, full of strawberry and bruised apple flavour with an oxidative kick, but also really well balanced. I mean, it's a bit crazy, but it's great fun.
Yeah, and it's pretty well balanced for Pet Nat, isn't it? Which, you know, Pet Nats can often be just a bit dull and a bit thin and a bit dry, but this one's fleshy, is dry, but it's got character and balance. It's a lovely quaffing wine, isn't it? And talking of crazy, their orange wine 2022, which I'm looking at now, packs quite a punch. Very cool label, made by a tattoo artist. We'll put a pic up on the site. It's very funky, isn't it? Very tannic. Maybe a bit too acidic and a bit too nail varnishy for me, but you liked it, didn't you?
I did. You're being unfair. It's mainly Albarino, which accounts for the acidity, along with Chardonnay, Solaris and Ortega, aged for a while in the bottle. It is a bit out there, but I like the slightly exotic kind of kumquat fragrance and then that chalky, yeasty palate texture that you expect from an orange wine. And I also actually think, to be fair to it, it needs the right food. It needs something quite rich but rustic.
I think that's rich but rustic, an appropriate note to end on. What an adventure this has been.
It really has.
We'll put the wine details, photos and links up on our website show notes, so do check those out. Meantime, by way of closing summary, England and Wales now has its very own counterculture wine movement, with exciting things being made all across the spectrum, from Pet Nat to orange to alternative traditional method, even to purple Welsh bubbles. The wines aren't cheap, but they are worthy of your time and attention, as I hope we proved in this episode, which we have very much enjoyed making.
We really have. And here's to more of these fun, you know, funky wines appearing in due course and people seeking them out. It's a sign of a healthy, diverse wine scene. Awesome. Thanks to Tommy Grimshaw, Susan and James Kinsey-Jones, Jose Quintana and Sergio Virillo. And of course, thanks to you for listening. Until next time, cheers.